Here we are still at Kalvi Bari Film Festival, and I have the honor to talk to director Mark Cousins about his recent documentary, or it's mixed between documentary film and series, because it has been presented as both, at least at festivals, The Story of Documentary Film.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad to be here. Yeah, I see it as a sort of big, long 16-hour film broken down into certain eras, you know, so we look at the 1950s and the bit that's here is the 1980s. And so hopefully it's watchable as 2 hour individual films or bingeable as a whole thing.
Your whole career has been shaped by looking at films in multiple ways, both from an academic perspective, from a personal perspective, from historic perspectives. When did that start, that passion for film?
Well, I've never been an academic, I have to say. I just, from childhood, I was poor at reading, but very good at imagery, very good at really responded to imagery in a way. And so I've made films about paintings and other visual culture things. I just had one of those brains that was a visual brain, not a verbal brain. And I came from a working class background. We didn't go to museums. We didn't go to theater. We didn't do anything like that. So cinema was a kind of medium that I could get inside my head.
That's an interesting point that we are hopefully going to come back to later. So you would say that passion for film was always there. And when did you start putting the film passion into film?
Yeah, I fell in love with cinema at the age of 8 and a half, and Tilda Swinton and I set up something called the 8 and a half Foundation for 8 and a half-year-old children who fell in love with cinema. I did not think I would make films because my father was a motor mechanic, my mom was a home helper. We didn't know anybody connected doing creative jobs, so I thought I might be a motor mechanic or something. But then I had some ideas when I was 22, wrote them on a napkin, you know, that you would find in a cafe, sent them to a British TV station, and they commissioned the napkin. So suddenly I was directing 6 short fiction films.
Your first big documentary looked at film, like fiction film mostly. Then what did comprise the idea to make another part to it that is documentary?
My first film was a documentary about Gorbachev, and then one about neo-Nazis and Holocaust deniers. And so I've made films about lots of subjects. When I made The Story of Film, The Odyssey that you refer to, there's a lot of documentary in there. I just thought I wanted to talk about the innovative nature of cinema in general. I've always been blind. I say all films are documentaries in some way. Jean-Luc Godard said that. But I think increasingly with what's happening politically in the world and countries going more to the far right in a number of countries, it felt time to look at documentary itself and ask how has it told the history of our times, our societies, our private lives, etc. So I think I wanted to look more towards reality at a time when the far right is telling lies about reality.
It's an interesting perspective. Everything is documentary, because you could also say that everything is fiction, especially if you look at the cinematic or the film history of documentary that always has been intertwined with fiction. Like some of the most famous documentaries are fiction films, like Nanook of the North is a fiction film, but it always has been seen as a documentary.
I think that idea, like if I put a camera on your face now, even if you were acting, still I would see the light in this room, the movement of your head. And so that basic reality capturing property of a camera, I think, is always there. I agree, lots of film, documentary films are manipulated or restage things. But even like Bernardo Bertolucci, a controversial figure now, he said that Last Tango in Paris is a documentary about Marlon Brando's face. So there is always a documentary impulse when a camera is used, I think.
With this huge body of film, where to start? Was it overwhelming?
I've done it mostly chronologically from the 1890s, because I felt that a lot of people don't know the basic story of documentary. But the very first film that I use is not from 1895, when we think documentary starts. It's from 1891, so before the birth of cinema in a way. And it's a 1 second long film directed by Georges Dumény, and he says, "Je vous aime," I love you. 1 second film saying I love you. And you could argue, I think it's one of the most beautiful, simple films ever made. I think also it tells us something about cinema. Cinema in some ways is trying to cherish life. Obviously cinema makes many mistakes and does very bad things, but it's also in some basic way trying to cherish landscapes, sunsets, the human face, cities, etc.
Chronological order might be one obvious focus. There of course is also internationality.
Yes.
Then there are aspects that go into film history of class, of societal structures, of politics, of all these things, who can make films and who tells the story.
Yeah.
And that's what I was kind of referring for when I said that everything is fiction, because it's always a very personal perspective that decides what part of reality, even if it is reality, is seen and perceived.
But that's not fiction. Yes, of course, all cinema is personal. Every documentary was made by somebody, and you're right, we have to ask who's telling the story, from where, when, and why. That doesn't mean it's fictional. It's personal. There's a big difference, I think, between fiction and subjectivity.
So how did you structure it, and did you at some point struggle with what to put in and what to take out?
Yeah, in front of me here, there's a meter wide sheet of paper, and along the top it says 1890s, 1910s, 20s, 30s, the decades, and then down the side here it's country by country, Japan, US, France, Africa, and I wrote all these names of films in. There are about 1,000 films here across this grid-like structure, and then I thought, here's the basic map that I want to explore. Let's say when I come to the 1960s, where there are a lot of films about protest, I then look back at earlier protest films and look forward to later protest films. So within the chronological structure, I can circle a bit and hopefully surprise people a little bit, because I want people to see the classic documentaries that they've heard of, but also discover other ones that they haven't heard of.
Were there certain works where you were insecure if you should take them in or take them out, maybe because they are either off the border of documentary and fiction or in some other way tricky to deal with?
I certainly haven't taken anything out because it's tricky to deal with. If anything, I was attracted to those films. You know, there's certain Japanese films. For example, there's one where an investigator beats up the guy he's interviewing. It's called Emperor's Naked Army Marches On. That's in. I left out, I haven't dealt with what's called mockumentaries, you know, that they're pretending to be documentaries, but they're not. I haven't dealt with that. But I'm very interested in the grey area films where people maybe take a real subject and restage it with actors and then have the real people interact with those actors. There are lots of films like that made, you know, from the UK to Brazil to many countries. Very interested in the kind of twilight zone, you could say, between the purely observational documentary and the documentary which is staging things to show something that perhaps we haven't seen.
Did you set yourself a certain time limit, or do you see it maybe as a work in progress where you can say, like, I always might add on, or I might put in more chapters?
Yes, that's possible. I thought to myself, let's try and make something about 15 or 16 hours, which is, if possible, you could start at Friday evening and binge all weekend, and then you go to see your friends or your work colleagues on Monday morning. You say, you'll never believe what I did. I watched a 16-hour film which about the history. So I think a weekend feels like a good amount of time if you really want to binge this. It takes a long time to make a film like this. It was roughly 5 years. I've had enough of documentary for a while, but I might return to it. You know, when I made the story of film an Odyssey all those years ago, I eventually returned and added a new chapter. So you're right, I might come back to this.
Was it hard at some point? Even if you say, like, you had enough of documentary or film for a while, was it hard to stop, to know, like, now this work is done? Because it can also be very hard with long-time projects to know when they're finished.
It's funny, you're right. I know a lot of people who can't close a project. It goes on and on. People sometimes who are writing PhDs and it takes them 10 years or something. I'm not like that. I love setting a deadline and then meeting it. For example, you notice I was early to meet you this morning. I always liked that. And so I knew when I had to stop, and I didn't, because I've got other projects and other films. So I didn't want this to stretch on like mozzarella.
Film is a history that's continuously being written.
Exactly.
So it's in progress, maybe like any histories. Did you then also set yourself a certain limit where you say, this is the end point and I'm doing everything that was before that?
Yes. As I was making this film, COVID happened, you know, and so I had time to really ask some broader questions about documentary in the era of COVID, for example. I wanted to come up as close as possible to the present day. And so there are films from last year in here, like A Beautiful Little Irish Film, for example. But at the very end, for the last sort of 10 minutes, I ask, what's the future look like for cinema? And there's a Colombian film that starts with an ending, and the filmmaker says, now it's your turn. So the very last thing I say after 16 years to the audience is, now it's your turn. You go out and make movies and show us your life and your world.
Is that realistic for most of the audience?
Absolutely. I mean, there's something like 4 billion cameras on phones in the world. So this is the most democratic time in the history of documentary cinema.
I was more thinking not so much of the number of cameras, but more of like the people who have access and the possibility to actually make a film. Because even if you say, like, oh no, every phone or most phones have a camera, not everybody necessarily has a phone. Not everybody has a phone that's good enough to make a film, and not everybody has the time and leisure to invest to make a film.
Of course, not everybody in the world, but it's far better. Most filmmakers have come from middle-class backgrounds, from the Western world, you know, so people from my background, working class, for example, it was impossible for them to make films. So it's far better than it was. Of course, there's still more to do. The river is becoming a delta and it's widening and widening. But there's no point just saying not everybody, because we have to celebrate the fact that for the first time in cinema history, a wide number of people from all around the world are making films and having them seen. This is a mostly positive, you're right, you know, but if you talk about the small number of people without cameras, then we forget to make the major democratic point that this art form is way more open than it ever was.
Might be more the absence of the necessary time and leisure than the absence of a camera itself. But to go back to this middle-class perspective, especially in the beginning of film history or in the first half, has been overwhelmingly shaped by middle-class perspectives.
Yeah.
How did that influence your work when making this documentary?
Well, it means that the very first bit, the first sort of until the late 1940s, I deal with quite quickly, because a lot of the films are very similar. You know, they were these, you know, well-meaning Europeans going out to other countries and trying to tell the stories of those other countries. But then when we get to the 1950s and the first African directors are making films about Africa themselves, then my story slows down and I open up to include all these other people. The way I dealt with it is to summarize the first bit, but then when there were more voices, when it became more democratic, then that's when the story enriches.
Did you apply the same approach to aspects of male gaze and certain classes perspectives and racist perspectives that go especially into, like we mentioned, Nanook of the North, which is strongly influenced by the colonist perspective? Did that also go with the same approach?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know if how much of this you've seen or what of my other work that you've seen, you know, but in terms of the male gaze phrase isn't one that I use much anymore. Certainly in this story of documentary film, the person who has, the only one filmmaker I've used five clips from, and it's Atayat Al-Abnoudi, the great Egyptian female director. And so there are loads and loads of female filmmakers in this. And even from Germany in 1930s, if we think of Germany in 1930s female filmmakers, one name comes to mind before any other, doesn't it? Leni Riefenstahl. But I've also got Ella Bergman-Michel, who's working at exactly the same time and doing equally interesting work. So the pleasure of challenging, let's say, a kind of sexist Europeanist history of cinema.
Was it hard to find these works in archives?
No, it wasn't, because I've been doing this kind of stuff, as you referred to earlier, for quite a long time. It means that the archives very kindly trust me. So I'll say to the Bulgarian archive or the Hong Kong archive or the Brazilian archive, please, can I see, you know, the sort of films that we're not usually seeing? Especially, I always, for decades, have been saying, who are your great female filmmakers, etc. And so it hasn't been difficult. You know, I think that what's happened is people have realized that they can trust me to, if they lend some materials, I can get them out in festivals like Carlo Bavari and Cannes and Berlinale, etc. Amplify these voices.
Have you seen something that changed your own perspective?
I think that because I've been doing this a long time, like I wrote a book on documentary cinema in the mid-90s, which is, you know, 30 years ago. So the overall history of documentary cinema, I was broadly aware of. But I think, for example, think of a country like Bulgaria, for example. I've been a long-term fan of Binka Zelyazkova's films. I saw a wonderful Bulgarian film called The Mosquito Problem and Other Stories. And that its mode of storytelling was, I haven't seen anything like it. The way it shapeshifts and becomes a different type of film and then a different type of film again. That's exciting. That's dazzling.
Do you see your work as specifically from a working class perspective, or would you say it's universal?
You know, I was brought up working class, but now I'm moving in festival circuits and staying in nice hotels. My own sense of the world has changed a little bit, but I'm certainly passionately international. And I think next week I go to Armenia to get a lovely prize for my work. The countries that have asked me for retrospectives and given me prizes are Egypt, Brazil, Portugal, Iran. So I feel radically determined to kind of have a sense of the whole world, at a particularly at a time when so many countries are increasing the border controls and trying to say to nationalities and peoples, you are special and you are better than those other people.
Are you working on something new? Maybe the story of animation film?
No, I'm not good at, because I make lots of films that are not about cinema. So for example, example, the film when I won the best film here in Carlo Vivari, it was for about a painter. So my next project is an opera. I'm writing an opera called The Bath, and it's about somebody who's in a cheap seat in a cheap airline, dreaming of being in a bath and dreaming about the world. The characters in the opera are Cleopatra, Jean-Paul Marat, and Charlotte Corday, French revolutionaries.
I'm still figuring out how Cleopatra got into the bath. Yeah, we all know that Marat got into the bath.
Yes. Well, Cleopatra apparently, so it says, she bathed in donkey milk with honey and herbs in it. And I've always been interested in Cleopatra. Somebody said to me yesterday, who would you most like to have dinner with in the world? And I said, Cleopatra. Because, you know, she was Greek and Egyptian, fascinating woman, her relationship with Julius Caesar and Mark Antony, all these, her use of power.
Thank you so much, Mark Cousins.
You're welcome. Thank you.